back before the days of electricity. There's a story about an old farmer. He was kind of a miser, looking for ways to save money wherever he could. He had a farmhand who, when he went out at night, he always took an oil lamp with him. He wanted to be able to see where he was going. And the farmer would razz him about it and get on to him about it. And one night, the young farmhand was going out to court his girlfriend, going out to see her, and he's got his lamp with him because it's dark, it's after hours. And the farmer saw him, and he razzed him, and he said, "Boy, when I was your age, I never needed lights like that. When I courted my wife, it was in the dark." And the young man thought for a moment. He said, "Yes, sir, I know. I've seen your wife. I'll take a lamp." Walking in darkness has its dangers. If you've ever gotten up in the middle of the night and your house is dark and you run into a door facing or a piece of furniture, you know that walking in darkness is dangerous. If you've ever walked in the house at night and stubbed your toe or tripped over a toy or stepped on something you didn't know was there, you know that walking in the dark can be a dangerous thing. Walking in the dark has spiritual dangers as well. I want us to look tonight at a statement by Jesus in John chapter 8, verse 12. "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but have the light of life." I want us to continue our series about the I am claims of Jesus, those amazing claims that Jesus makes in the Gospel of John. As we've talked about already, when he said I am, he's connecting himself with the I am of the Old Testament, God himself. This is nothing less than a claim to absolute deity. And we've looked at some of the background of that. We looked at the statement in Exodus chapter 3 where God told Moses to tell the Israelites, telling them that I am has sent you, I am that I am. And we've also looked at some similar statements in the Old Testament, particularly from Isaiah, where in the Greek Old Testament, you've got the same verbiage as you find in John's Gospels. But clearly, Jesus is making a claim to deity in these claims about being I am this or that. Tonight, we're going to look at John 8, and we're actually going to look at verses 12 through 20. Jesus claimed to be the light of the world. The occasion for this in John chapter 7, the entirety of John 7, 8, 9, and the first part of John chapter 10, it appears to be exactly the same incident. This is where John really elaborates on this one incident. John chapter 7, after this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. And then it says in verse 2, "Now the Jews' feast of booths was at hand, and so his brothers said to him, 'Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples may also see the works that you are doing.'" The Feast of Booths was at hand. This would have been in the fall. It was in the seventh month, Tishrei, celebrated on the 15th through the 21st of Tishrei, which was September or October. It was after the grape harvest in the fall. It started 5 days after the Day of Atonement, which was also celebrated in the seventh month on the 10th day. This brought to a close the Feast of Tabernacles, Feast of Booths, depending on what version you're reading, brought to a close the annual cycle of feasts and festivals that began back in the spring with Passover. You had Passover, and then 50 days later you had Pentecost, and then you had the Day of Atonement, and then it ended up with this celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. It celebrated the wilderness wanderings. It's called the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. The word tabernacle or booth that's used here just meant a tent. It meant a temporary type of structure. And what the Jews would do, they would literally cover the streets of Jerusalem with these tents. Basically, they were lean-tos is what most of them were. They put up a few sticks and cover it with some palm fronds or something like that, and they would sleep out in the open during that week of celebration. The festivities lasted 7 days, and then on the eighth day was the final assembly. If you look in John chapter 7, verse 37, on the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out. And so this is a reference to the final day of that feast. And it seems that pretty much everything else that happens through chapter 7, through chapter 8, through chapter 9, and even the first part of chapter 10. All of this is clearly done in and around Jerusalem. So we assume that this is probably all during the Feast of Tabernacles. Theologically, as I said, it signified their wilderness wanderings. During the wilderness, they lived in tents, and it celebrated the idea that God took care of them. They were to be reminded that their, I think this probably helped emphasize the concept of sojourning, traveling to the promised land. But there were two main symbols that were connected with it. One was water. Obviously, with a lot of the festivals, there was a lot of sacrifice going on. And water came to be a symbol that was connected to the Feast of Tabernacles. We just read from John chapter 7, verse 37. And I think Jesus' hearers would have understood this as a reference to the water that flowed freely during the Feast of Tabernacles, John 7, verse 37. On the last day, last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." So I think that's clearly a reference to the festivities connected with the Feast of Booths. But also light was a prominent feature during the Feast of Tabernacles. They would construct and erect in the court of women within the temple four large candelabras, or four large menorahs. Basically, they were these really tall lamps. Each one had four bowls at the top. And four men every day would climb up to the top of this and light these bowls. They carried up a container with, about 10 gallons of oil for each of these four gigantic lamps that were in the courtyard of the temple. And they would fill these up, and these lamps would burn. And it would symbolize the pillar of fire that led the Israelites through the wilderness. And so light was connected with this. This was probably the most popular of the festivities that the Jews attended. They came to refer to it just as the feast, in shorthand. And the celebrants would spend every night basically partying and dancing all night long. The pious people felt that it was that the goal was to stay up all night, every night, and not get any sleep during the festival. And they would literally do that. You would have these distinguished rabbis out in the street. One rabbi had, there's a record of this one rabbi handling or juggling like seven different lanterns without dropping any of them on the floor. I mean, this turned into a real festivity. So this was a wildly popular festival that Jesus attends here. So that's the background of this particular event. It is connected with, starts back in John chapter 7, with Jesus attending kind of in private. He goes up in private to the Feast of Booths. I think it continues on into chapter 8. Now, there appear to be in John chapter 8, I think, four basic conflicts. First of all, there's a conflict between law and grace, and that's exhibited in John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11, with the woman who is caught in adultery. Now, there's a lot of discussion about whether or not that story even belongs in the text of John's gospel. From what I can tell, I don't think the story probably even belongs there. The textual evidence for it is dubious. There are some manuscripts, some important manuscripts that don't even have the story. And there's some reasons for thinking that the story really doesn't fit there. Now, in my opinion, I think the story of the woman caught in adultery in John 8, I do believe it's an authentic story of Jesus. I can't imagine some rabbi making up or scribe making up a story like this. I think it's an authentic Jesus story. Whether or not it belongs in John's gospel is another issue altogether. But nonetheless, there's a conflict between law and grace. Will Jesus follow the letter of the law and stone this woman? And Jesus acts out of complete grace and forgives her. He doesn't condone her sin, but he forgives her and condemns the duplicitous actions of her accusers. Then there is this contrast between light and darkness. Are they going to follow the light, or are they going to continue to walk in darkness? That's chapter 8, verses 21 through 30. Then the question about freedom and bondage. If you follow Jesus, if you are his disciple, you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And Jesus' enemies say, well, we've never been in bondage to anybody. And so it brings up a discussion about freedom and bondage. And finally, there is this business of honoring or dishonoring your father. Well, they have Father Abraham. And that's also one of these statements that Jesus makes in the chapter. I tell you that before Abraham was, I am. And they pick up stones and they're ready to stone him. So John chapter 8 is just full of challenging thinking, challenging discussion. So much of what goes on in John 7 through 10 is just Jesus in conversation, kind of perpetual conversation with the people in Jerusalem as he attended this feast and a lot of the conflicts that arise from that. One other thing before we actually get into the text, and that is John's use of light and dark, lightness and darkness as a metaphor in his gospel. If you go back to chapter 1, it's pretty clear that John wants us to think very much like the beginning of the story of Genesis. He's using creation kind of as a motif, as a way of beginning his gospel here in John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So this takes us all the way back to the beginning of all things. I'm sure that John's readers are hearing a rereading of the book of Genesis, and there's a lot in John chapter 1 that I think reflects the creation story of the book of Genesis. But he is the source of both light and life. In verse 4, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. Life and light are both connected in John's gospel. And the whole idea of life and light, life is truly more fundamental than light. I do think that's true, but nonetheless, the two are connected, and you can't have one without having the other. Life and light, he says, come from him. In him was this. Not just that he brought this, not just that he gave this. He was this. He was the absolute source of this because he was God. There's also a principle in verse 5. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Now, you know from your own experiences that light always overpowers darkness. Light always overpowers darkness. You can be in a room without any light, without any windows, without any doors, or everything is nice and shut up, and you can have no electricity whatsoever, and if you just flick on a match, if you flick on a small flashlight, you can see from a great distance. When we lived out in Iowa the last 3 years that we were there, we lived out in the country. And one of the things I loved about living in the country is there's no light out there. We had a yard light that we could turn off and on from the house. And there were times we just liked to turn off the light and just enjoy the darkness. But the interesting thing was you could see about 3 miles away, you could see the city of Slater. You could see lights from the city. About 8 miles away, you could see lights from the city of Madrid. About 12 to 15 miles away, you could see lights from the city of Boone. About 10 miles away, you could see lights from the city of Ames. And about 35 miles away to the south, there was couple of spots you could stand in our yard or on the road in front of our house. You could see the lights from downtown Des Moines. It didn't matter how dark it was, you could see the light. Light always overpowers darkness. That is true of God's physical creation. But the point he's making here in John 1 verse 5 is it's true of his moral creation as well. Light overpowers darkness. And that light symbolizes the power of God. He also uses an interesting concept starting in verse 6. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. And he came as a witness to bear witness about the light that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. And then he talks about the true light, which comes into the world there in verse 9. I think what he's wanting us to think about is the reference in Genesis 1 to the greater lights and the lesser lights. There is the true light, and that is Jesus. And then there's someone like John who comes and testifies about the light. In a sense, he's this lesser light. There's the illumination that light brings in verse 9. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. Jesus brought light that everyone could see. Not everybody accepted it, but he brought light that illuminated the entire world. Then in John chapter 3, verse 19, John chapter 3, down in verse 19. And this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people loved the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his work should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. Spiritually speaking, there's a lot of cockroaches in this world. You ever notice what cockroaches do when you turn the light on? They scatter. And he says, spiritually speaking, there are people who do not want to see the light. They prefer darkness over light. Now, there are times when I prefer a nice dark room, but I'll tell you what, I'd hate to live in darkness. A fundamental feature of light is that it exposes things. We need light for our physical existence, and we need light for our spiritual existence. And that's what it provides for us. And one other thing is that we can be sons of light. We can follow the light, and that can give us the life that we need. John chapter 12, in verse 35 and 36, the light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in the darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light. And by the way, John chapter 12, after John 12, there are no more references to light in John's gospel. You remember what happens after John 12? Crucifixion. John 13 is Jesus' last supper with the apostles. His discourses, John 13 through chapter 17, his various discourses with the apostles on the last night of his earthly life, and then his arrest, his betrayal, his arrest, his execution. No more references to light. I will say this, Jesus was resurrected at first light on the first day of the week. I don't know that he uses the word light there when he talks about the resurrection, but I would suggest that that may be the antidote to it, that when you get to the resurrection, the light has dawned yet again. But I think it's interesting how John uses this metaphor of light and darkness throughout his gospel. So by the time you get to John chapter 8, you shouldn't be surprised when he pulls out this light and dark imagery. Now, what about Jesus' listeners? A lot of what, there are these statements that we read about earlier in John. I suspect that for Jesus' listeners at the Feast of Tabernacles in Jerusalem, they probably resonated with that. They understood the reference because of the giant menorahs in the temple and the constant burning of the lights at night. I think they probably understood it. John's readers, though, he's kind of prepared us for that. So when you get to it, it's the perfectly natural thing for Jesus to say. Let's turn our attention now to John chapter 8. I simply want to look at verses 12 through 20, this particular unit. I think it's just kind of an interesting thing. Again, Jesus spoke to them saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. So the Pharisees said to him, you're bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true. Jesus answered, even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true, for I know where I came from and where I am going. But you do not know where I came from or where I am going. You judge according to the flesh, I judge no one. Yet even if I do judge, my judgment is true, for it is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent me. In your law it is written that the testimony of two people is true. I am the one who bears witness about myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me. They said to him, therefore, where is your Father? Jesus answered, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. These words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, but no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. So that's the light of the world exchange that Jesus makes with the Pharisees. In the temple during the Feast of Tabernacles. First of all, you have Jesus' declaration. It is one of the several I Am declarations that we have been looking at in our series. This is the second one sequentially. The first one is back in John 6 where he claims to be the bread of life. Here he says he is the light of the world. Even those two declarations I think are interesting because he's pointing to very basic things. We depend on bread for our sustenance. Bread is probably considered the most basic food that everybody needs. You have bread, you've got at least a little bit of food. In Matthew 6, Jesus encouraged his disciples to pray, "Give us this day our daily bread." In the very miracle where Jesus proclaims that he is the bread of life, he feeds the 5,000 with what? With loaves and fishes, with fish and bread. Bread was a basic food. And now he talks about himself being the light of the world. Light is one of the most fundamental things that is necessary for existence of life here on earth. We need light in order to live. And so he says, "I am the light of the world." And then he goes on to say that whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Again, I think it fits in very well with the Feast of Tabernacles, the emphasis upon following the light. Isn't that exactly what the Israelites did in the wilderness? You go back to the book of Exodus. Back in the book of Exodus, you go back to the reference to the pillar of fire. That's back in Exodus chapter 13. In verse 18, "But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. The people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, 'God will surely visit you and shall carry up my bones with you from here.' And they moved on from Succoth and encamped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And God went before them, the Lord went before them, by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people." The very idea that God provides light, and what do? You follow the light. And that's the point that Jesus says, "I am the light of the world," and the application his hearers were expected to make is, "Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness." Now again, you've probably had the experience of walking in a dark place. Now, it's nice that these days you can use your phone. It's got a little flashlight button on it. That's nice to have. So if you get up in the middle of the night and you can't find the flashlight on your nightstand, if you got your phone, you're doing good. Have you ever been out camping at night, out in the wild, out in the forest? I know whenever we go camping, we take a lantern with us. And you stay within that aura of light. If you get outside that aura of light, where are you? You're in the darkness. He's saying there's the light. There is this lighted area that God provides. You stay within that, and you're just fine. You avoid the pitfalls. You avoid the dangers. And also, by following the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire, where did it ultimately lead them? It led them to the promised land. You want to make it safely to the destination, you follow the light. You always do that. And Jesus said, "Therefore, I am the light of the world." If you want to make it safely to the promised land, you follow me. And again, that very much fits with the imagery of the Feast of Tabernacles. It was a celebration, a reminder of Israel's time in the wilderness and God's provisions for them. So Jesus takes what God did in the Old Testament for Israel and he applies it to himself. "I'm the light of the world. Follow me and you won't walk in darkness, but you will have the light of life." The light that gives life, the light that leads to life. And that's the claim that he makes. And by the way, following here I think is an interesting choice of words. The word occurs quite a bit by the time we get to chapter 8. If you look back in chapter 1, all the way back in chapter 1, verse 37 and 38, when two of his disciples, Andrew and John, are introduced to Jesus, the two disciples, verse 37, heard him say this, and they followed Jesus. And he turned and saw them following. He invites them to stay with him. Verse 40, one of the two who heard John speak and followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. A little bit later, in verse 43, the next day Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Sometimes people figured out who Jesus was and they followed on their own. In other cases, Jesus invited people to follow him. That's exactly what's going on in John chapter 8, verse 12. It's an invitation to follow him as the light. Now, one other point needs to be made about following Jesus. There were people who voluntarily followed Jesus. We looked at this back in chapter 6. Chapter 6, verse 2, a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Many of them continued to follow, not for the right reasons. But if you follow Jesus, and you follow him for the right reasons, and you follow him because he is the source of life, ultimately you find that life that God promises. Now, he makes that declaration in verse 12, and the Pharisees raise an objection. I object. They say in verse 13, the Pharisees said to him, "You are bearing witness about yourself, but your testimony is not true." I don't know if you've ever noticed this about the Pharisees. It's clear that they were the worst listeners on the planet, because often what they would say in reply to Jesus had nothing to do with anything that Jesus said. They were masters at just ignoring the obvious. He makes this great declaration, "I am the light of the world." At least challenge him on that. They say, well, wait a minute, you can't testify about yourself. I mean, just completely ignoring the great statement that Jesus just made. Well, who's going to testify on your behalf? You can't make these claims. Their objection is not to the validity of Jesus' claims. Their objection is a legal objection. Pharisees were legalists, and so they're doing what they do best. They raise objections in a legalistic manner. The law required multiple witnesses. Let everything be established on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Passages like that occur numerous times in the Old Testament. If you were to bring a charge against someone, and so this is kind of a negative concept, if you bring a charge against someone, there has to be multiple attestation. And so in a technical legal sense, they're sort of right. If Jesus is giving testimony only by himself with no corroborating evidence, they would actually be right. But that's simply not the case. Now, I can testify on my behalf, and what I may say is true, but that doesn't prove anything unless there are other witnesses. Jesus, I think, in principle, understands that. Now, he addresses that a few verses down the page. You go back to John chapter 5. John chapter 5. In verse 30, I can do nothing on my own. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just because I seek not my own will, but the will of the one who sent me. If I alone bear witness about myself, my testimony is not true. Jesus understood what the law said about testimony. And so here in John chapter 5, he goes on with this list of witnesses. There is another who bears testimony about me, and that is John the Baptist. And then verse 36, I have testimony that's even greater than that of John. Look at the works that I do. And then there is the testimony of the Father. There is the testimony of Scripture. So Jesus understood the principle. But his reply suggests that he's actually got something else in mind. His reply to them in verse 14, even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true. For I know where I came from, and I know where I'm going, but you do not know where I come from or where I'm going. You judge according to the flesh, I judge no one. Yet even if I do judge, my judgment is true, for it is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent me. In your law it is written that the testimony of two people is true. I am the one who bears witness about myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me. Basically, he says, you're right. You're right. If I give testimony about myself, even if it's true, it may not be legally valid. So I'll give you another witness. I'll give you my Father. Now that pretty well torques him off. Let's kind of see how he arrives at that. If I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true. He goes to this business about his origin. They were ignorant of where Jesus came from. Now, I don't think it's ignorance of the facts. It's ignorance, it's willful ignorance. If you go back to John chapter 5, when they had complained about his giving testimony about himself, he gave witnesses. There's not a lack of evidence for Jesus' claim. There's a lack of people listening to Jesus' claim. Jesus made these claims. He gave the evidence for it. That's the whole point of John's gospel. How do we know that Jesus is the Son of God? The signs that he gave, the works that he performed. Look at that. And Jesus also says, look at what my Father said about me. Jesus says, look at what Scripture said about me. there's plenty of evidence. So their objection is just quibbling. And Jesus points that out. He said, I realize that if I testify by myself, yeah, I realize you're not going to accept that. But he says, the problem is you don't know where I came from. You don't know where I'm going. And then he turns the table on them in verse 15. You judge according to the flesh. Your problem is you're using the wrong yardstick. You're using the wrong kind of criteria to judge my statements. You're judging according to the flesh. You're judging according to appearance. You're judging according to some abstract legal standard. He says, what you're forgetting about is that my Father has sent me. I and the Father are one. The Father has testified about me. What might be a ludicrous statement by anyone else makes perfect sense on the lips of Jesus because Jesus was God. That's the thing that they forgot about. You know, if I were to stand up here and say, I'm the light of the world, you'd laugh me to scorn and you'd fire me on the spot. And you'd have good reason for that. You know me. You've been around me. I'm not that bright. I'm not the kind of light bulb you want in your fixtures at home. You understand my limitations. But when Jesus said, I am the light of the world, he spoke with the credibility of the divine. He was God in the flesh. He came from God the Father. So what might appear to be a ludicrous statement by anybody else has absolute credibility with Jesus because Jesus was God. And so he can refer to the testimony of his Father. The testimony of his Father validates the testimony of Jesus. And I think that's really the point that he's making here. It is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent me. In your law it is written, verse 17, that the testimony of two people is true. I am the one who bears witness about myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me as well. So he says, okay, I'll play your game. I'll give you my testimony, and I'll give you the testimony of the Father. Which rattles their cage a little bit. And by the way, from verse 15 on through the rest of the chapter, remember that list of four conflicts in the chapter? Basically, Jesus now turns the tables on them, and for the rest of the chapter, they are on the defensive. They're scrambling to try to keep up with Jesus. He keeps accusing them, and now they have to defend themselves. They asked him for evidence. They asked him for additional testimony. Now he throws it back at them and says, well, what are you going to prove about yourselves? So I think John 8, verse 15, in many ways is a turning point in the rest of the discussion in John chapter 8, because now he puts them on the defensive. Well, that brings up one other point by them. They raise a question. Well, where is your Father? Now here again, you think, why do they even ask this? This seems a little bit out of left field. And I suspect what they have in mind is what you see in John chapter 9. In John chapter 9, the man is born blind and Jesus heals him. And they start asking the man, you know, there's a debate. Well, is this the guy that was really blind and people who have known him? Yeah, it is. You know, we've known him since he was a kid. And someone else says, no, you got to be making a mistake. And they brought, verse 13 of John 9, they brought to the Pharisees the man who had been formerly blind. It was a Sabbath day. And they ask what happened. He explains it. And then in verse 17, they said again to the blind man, what do you say about him since he has opened your eyes? And he said, he is a prophet. The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man. This man can't speak on his own, so let's go ask his parents. He obviously doesn't know anything. And I think that's what they have in mind here in John chapter 8 when they raise the question in verse 19, well, where is your Father? We want to go talk to him. Now, I think that's a little bit funny because in other places in the Gospels, when people marvel at the teachings of Jesus, you remember what they said? Isn't this the son of Joseph and Mary? It seems like everybody knew about Jesus except the Pharisees. This goes back to the issue that the problem is they are blind not because they can't see, not because they lack credible information. They are blind because they choose to be blind. Well, where's your Father? We want to talk to your Father. We'll hear his side of things. You just invoked your Father as a witness. So tell us where your Father is. And Jesus said, this is Jesus' second reply. He says in verse 19, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. Which simply exposes the fact, you go back to his claim, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. He simply exposes the fact they're not walking in the light. They are not following the light which God has provided in his Son, Jesus. They are blind because they are willfully blind. Now, I wonder if they got it or not. There's a part of me that says that they probably did because of what John says in verse 20. These words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, but no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. Why does John stick that little note in there? I think John is telling us they probably did understand, probably better than they wanted to let on. Most likely they did understand. Most likely if it had been within their power, they probably would have killed him on the spot or at least arrested him. But his hour had not yet come, so it's not within the Father's purpose. They're not going to arrest him because they couldn't. But I suspect at this point there are some people who very much wanted to. Remember we talked about this being the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles. Later in John chapter 10, we're told that that Jesus went to Jerusalem at the Feast of Dedication, which happened in about December. So I take this as meaning this is about 6 months before Jesus' execution. So by this time, he has established enemies. By this time, people know who he is. They know what he claims. I think the Pharisees, to be honest, are playing dumb. They don't get it because they don't want to get it. They throw up these objections. Well, you can't testify on behalf of yourself because they don't really want to know the truth about Jesus. Show us your Father. Jesus has shown them the Father time and again in his words and his deeds and his character. They have seen that time and again. They simply refuse to believe, and that's the problem. So Jesus here claims to be the light of the world. I want to conclude that there's an old story, and this is probably an apocryphal story. History has a way of developing these interesting stories, that most of which aren't true. There's a story that dates to the French Revolution, and one of the turning points, one of the flash points in the French Revolution was the storming of the Bastille. The Bastille was this old medieval fortress, this medieval castle right in the center of Paris. It came to symbolize the power of the aristocracy, and people were sick and tired of it. So on July 14, 1789, a mob broke into this Bastille, hoping to find something. They really didn't find much of anything. There was a little bit of gunpowder stored there. It had been used as a prison, but by the time the Bastille was stormed, there were only 7 prisoners in the place. And legend has it that as they brought these 7 prisoners out into the light, there was this one older man who had been there a very long time, and he kind of gotten used to the darkness. And when they brought him out into the light, he complained. He said, I can't take this. Let me go back in. I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but I'll tell you what Jesus said back in John chapter 3. In John chapter 3, he warned about people like this. John chapter 3 in verse 19, and this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people loved the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. Some people prefer darkness to light. I think that's weird. I like darkness at times. I like darkness in limited doses, but I love the light. I want to live in a nice sunny place. I want to have lights on in the house when I'm at home. I love light, and I can't imagine what it would be like to live in darkness. But there are people in this world who prefer spiritual darkness to spiritual light. So even if that story isn't true from the Bastille, there are people spiritually who are just like that. And we have to make sure that we love the light more than we love the darkness. The problem that people had with Jesus is not that there was no evidence. It's not that they couldn't figure out whether or not he was the light of the world, whether he was the light that provided an escape from darkness. The problem is they had their eyes closed. Can you imagine taking somebody out into broad daylight on a nice sunny day like we had today? Can you imagine taking somebody else, somebody out with you and saying, isn't the sunlight great? And they say, sunlight? What sunlight? I don't see any sunlight. The only way you cannot see sunlight is if you're physically incapable of it or if you got your eyes closed. That's the only way to not see sunlight. Sunlight is so bright you can't miss it. The light of the Son of God is so great you can't miss it unless you got your eyes closed. And what you need to understand is you got to ask yourself, are you walking in the light? John uses that same metaphor over in 1 John. If we walk in the light as he himself is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus cleanses us from all sin. You can have that tonight. You can have that before you leave here. If you're walking in darkness, if you've never obeyed Jesus as Lord, by definition, you are in darkness because you're not following the light that God has given. So if you're not a Christian, you need to walk in the light. For those of us that are Christians, sometimes we fail. Sometimes we go back into the world of sin. And it's a failure to walk consistently as we know we ought to walk. And if you need to make corrections in your spiritual life as a Christian, we want to help you with that. Think about that while we stand and sing.